to reflect on is not that you have animals like Bibi and Bandar in the world. They've always existed.
They've always existed.
They've always done these things.
Yes.
The issue is, why would those people who are the elites, who are, you know, from your homes and your families and your colleges and your towns and your churches and your synagogues and your, you know, mosques, why would these people who, you know, they're your cousins, they're your dads, your uncles, your, you know, brothers, your husbands, your wives, why would they even look at these people like Bibi and Bandar and consider them even worthy of their
attention?
Right. Where there's other people that they could be, you know, a nice, civilized, educated person. Okay? So the point I'm trying to simply make is, you know, why wouldn't you want to have good relations with a country like Iran that has is a republic, that has elections, that has, you know, a deep, you know, complex structure where people are involved, where you have local elections, where you have 800,000, you know, people in this population running for...
Well, I think...
That you have a leader who talks about, you know, progress and standard of living and, you know, healthcare and education and technology and, you know, the main thing in life being that you have more knowledge. And why would you want not align yourself with that and align yourself with Bandar?
Well, I think the other thing is that, you know, honestly, that the, you know, we come back to that NAM summit as well. I think that in itself said everything, that, you know, the majority of nations in this world are tired of this hegemony and they really do want to ally themselves with Iran. And, you know, wanting to make broader ties and expand ties and, you know, to learn about this Islamic civilization as well, as we've discussed before. And it just leaves me to say, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. May the peace and mercy and blessings of Allah be upon you all. Thank you very much for listening. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad.
The light. Animals have been providing protection and service to people since time immemorial. They have not only been the source of food like meat, butter and milk, but also served humans by eating plants toxic to them. Authorities in New York City have taken 24 goats from a nearby farm to the Riverside Park in Manhattan to munch on invasive weeds. They say it's an environmentally friendly win-win for the species removal at the park. The goats get to feast on overgrown bush, and Riverside Park Conservancy doesn't have to dump harsh chemicals on weeds. Park officials say it's both healthy for the goats and good for the environment.
As part of our woodland restoration initiative, 2 years ago, we unleashed a very hungry group of goats into a stretch of the park that had been overrun with invasive plants. And wow, did they exceed expectations. We called it Gotham because we put the goat in Gotham. They chowed down on Japanese knotweed. They noshed on porcelain berry. They snacked on multiflora rose. They easily traversed the hard-to-reach terrain behind me and gulped down poison ivy without even giving it a second thought. Since goats are naturally effective weed whackers, putting them to work in Gotham is like treating them to an all-you-can-eat buffet. It's healthy for the goats, and it's good for the environment. That's farm to table.
People visiting the goats at the zoo say these animals are emotionally intelligent and connect with people. Goats are an ingenious approach to weed removal, eating species dangerous to humans like poison ivy. Of the 24 goats, 5 will call Riverside Park its home through the end of August. For some others, the public can vote to determine which goat will be crowned the greatest of all time. The winner will be announced by the end of the summer.
Singapore unveils one of the world's biggest floating solar panel farms in a bid for quadrupling its solar energy production by 2025. The farm is as big as 45 football fields. It includes 122,000 solar panels. The panels are designed to last for 25 years, and drones will be used to assist with maintenance. The farm is located on a reservoir in western Singapore and will generate enough electricity to power its 5 water treatment plants. It puts Singapore among the few countries in the world with a water treatment system fully powered by green energy. The farm can reduce Singapore's carbon emissions by 32,000 tons annually. Floating solar panels perform up to 15% better than conventional rooftop panels. That's because of the cooling effect of water and that shading from other buildings does not affect them. Singapore is currently developing 4 other floating solar panel projects. Baby kittens are considered the cutest baby animals by many of us, but just wait to see this baby hippo, which was born during a full moon. The male cub was born in a Mexican zoo last month. He weighs 30 kilos upon birth. Since then, he has spent most of his time bonding with his mother. The vets in the zoo say he is healthy, playful, strong, and a bit hyperactive. They say some of his habits are surprisingly similar to that of a horse or a dolphin. Generally, reproduction among zoo hippos is not a common practice. Therefore, newborn calves are signs of high quality of the lives and habitats of their parents. A zoo in central France is welcoming the birth of a male giraffe after 15 months of waiting. The calf is named after Melman, the giraffe character in the Madagascar movie franchise. He was born on Sunday in a Beauval Zoo park. He is 170 centimeters tall and weighs 55 kilograms. Zookeepers say Melman is a special baby.
A giraffe birth here. It's our second birth since we've had the group of females established for a few years. So for us, it's still quite an important and exceptional event because it's not every day that we have a giraffe birth.
The giraffe keepers say Melman stood on his feet for the first time 45 minutes after being born. Since zoos have opened in France, visitors can enjoy seeing little Melman playing around with his mother. The birth of the baby giraffe is good news for wildlife preservation, as according to estimates, the number of the animal in the wild has dropped by about 30% since the 1980s.
The issue of marine trash has long worried scientists and environmentalists. Now a French engineer has invented a robot to help clean ocean waste. The Jellyfish Bot is a remote-controlled electric-powered boat that helps clean rubbish from the surface of the water. It's 70 centimeters long and 70 wide, almost the size of a suitcase. The robot can collect everything from plastic bottles to masks and even oil and petrol. Despite its wide-ranging utility, Jellyfish Bot has a rather simple mechanism.
To collect trash, you have to do something as simple as possible, because otherwise, if we put too complicated mechanisms, it can get blocked and things can get stuck in the system. We designed the robot with a slide mechanism that goes towards a net, so we fill up the net, we take back the net, and that's the end of it.
The trash-collecting robot is being used at around 15 ports in France, lightening the workload of local cleaners. It has also been exported to countries including Japan, Norway, and Singapore. The makers have also developed an autonomous version of the boat.
Malaysians at a vaccination center in the city of Kuching have witnessed a surprising scene. A T-Rex turned up to get his COVID-19 jab. Fitness instructor Kenny Sia dressed up in a dinosaur costume to amuse people, doesn't he look fabulous, and protect himself. Sia said he made the decision to lift up the spirits of frontline health workers, is exhausted by vaccinating over 5,000 people a day. People rushed to take pictures with him, hailing his appearance and historic. Funny. A giant 3D cat has risen to fame in the Japanese capital, Tokyo, bringing joy to citizens amid the COVID-19 pandemic. A massive billboard featuring the cat has been installed in one of Tokyo's busiest districts. The realistic-looking cat on a 4K resolution screen appears every few minutes between advertisements. Depending on the time of day, the cat appears differently and sometimes meowing at people walking by. The companies that set up the billboard hope that they can cheer people up during the dark era of the coronavirus pandemic. The display has already caused a frenzy in the city and among the social platforms, with many expressing joy and amazement at the technology.
Peru is full of natural wonders worthy of appreciation in each of its regions. A zoo in the capital, Lima, has now unveiled an incredibly cute and adorable Andean alpaca calf to attract visitors amid dwindling zoo-goers due to the coronavirus pandemic. This furry baby alpaca named Paquita is just 1 month old and was introduced to the public on the eve of the 200th anniversary of Peru's independence from Spain. The zoo has also displayed its families of llamas, alpaca, and vicuña. The three are members of South American camelids biological family and are traditionally valued for their soft and warm wool. They live in the Andes Mountains, which lay thousands of meters above sea level. Peruvians are proud of the history of wools associated with these species, which have common ancestors with camels.
The Light is a short bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Four German tightrope walkers have set a new world highlining distance record by crossing an Arctic valley in Sweden. The group tiptoed a distance of more than 2 kilometers between two mountain peaks in Lapland barefoot. The line they walked on was set at a height of 600 meters. The four members of the team walked the line one after another successfully, despite challenges including the wind and long distance. It took 2 days for the team to rig the line between the two peaks.
Herd of elephants migrating in China have been making headlines for months. Now they have once again attracted attention. Experts monitoring the animals this week noticed two females engaged in a dramatic fight over the herd's leadership, where they kicked and bit each other. The tussle soon ended after a male elephant succeeded in calming the belligerent giants. The fight happened in China's southwestern province of Yunnan. The herd embarked on a lengthy journey last year after escaping a nature reserve and has since trekked hundreds of miles. The elephant's migration is the longest one in China's history. A distinctive feature, no matter of humans or animals, often catches our attention. You might have heard stories about the big fat cow or other animals you love the most. Here we bring you a story about a cow for her not being big, but for being the smallest. Rani, a 23-month-old cow, is being reared on a farm near the Bangladeshi capital, Dhaka. She is only 20 inches tall and weighs 26 kilograms. Local vets say the little Rani has no physical problems but will no longer gain any weight or height. The owner believes Rani is shorter than the smallest cow in Guinness World Record. The record for the smallest cow so far held by a 4-year-old red cow named Manikyam from the Indian state of Kerala.
We found on the internet that the smallest known cow is living in India's Kerala, which weighs 40 kilograms.
but ours weighs only 26, so we believe ours is the world's smallest. That's why we applied to the Guinness World Records. They replied to us saying they will investigate within 90 days.
The tiny cow has also caused tourist frenzy in the South Asian country as thousands are flocking to Dhaka to take a glance despite coronavirus restrictions. The owner says only that is over 15,000 people come to visit her in just 3 days. The dwarf cow has also gone viral on social media. A nearly 22-meter-high sand sculpture in Denmark has set a new Guinness record as the world's tallest sandcastle. The sculpture has been constructed with nearly 5 tons of sand. It's made in the shape of a triangle, and a wood structure stabilizes it. More than 30 artists from different countries have worked on the project, carving intricate details on the castle's wall. Its makers say a nod to the coronavirus pandemic was also made at the top of that construction. They say that's because the virus has controlled the lives of people over the past months. The sand piece broke the previous Guinness record that belonged to an 18-meter-high sand castle in Germany. An adorable baby elephant has become a web celebrity after she was caught on camera using a muddy hill as playground slide. Footage shows the little elephant excitedly approaching a hill with a smooth path leading downward. The baby then goes on all fours to have the time of her life sliding on her belly down the hill, taking full advantage of rain. The toddler, named Yishong, is only 3 years old. She lives at a rescue center in China, one of the major habitats for wild Asian elephants in the country.
A French company has taken the process of pizza making to a whole new level by creating a robot chef. The robot named Patsy is completely autonomous. The machine, now working in a pizzeria in Paris, is capable of taking orders, making a pizza from scratch and serving it. Having three arms, the robot can make 120 pizzas in an hour, which is 13 times faster than a human chef.
We are in a very fast process with a perfect control of time and quality, since we have a constancy offered by robotics and then an environment that is quite cool and relaxed. The idea is also to spend a few pleasant minutes washing the robot while you wait for your pizza to be made.
It took designers 8 years to develop the machine, which is claimed to be the first pizza-making robot in the world. They hope to use the technology to open robotics-run restaurants that can function round the clock. In China, scientists are happy that the world's first artificially bred leaf monkey is doing well 2.5 months after being born. The rare monkey was born at a research and protection center in Wuzhou City in April. Its birth took place several days earlier than the due date, and the baby was relatively weak at birth. However, thanks to its parents and caretakers, it has grown in a normal way. Scientists say the baby monkey is now in a good condition and its behavior is totally normal.
It is very important in terms of the cytic value. It has been growing up normally. In addition, we have found that it has a curiosity about the world and always shows some exploratory and learning behaviors. In general, it is in very good physical condition.
The center's scientists say another leaf monkey that was born in April is doing well too. These monkeys are the 8th generation of leaf monkeys that have been bred in captivity. Their successful births have raised hope amongst the scientists of saving a species that is one of China's most endangered wild animals.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. Both Haiti and Cuba for decades have been subjected to actions and policies from the United States and others, both overt and covert, which have undermined self-determination and economic independence at every conceivable juncture. We now present you an article written by Richard Sudan, a journalist, writer, and television reporter. The piece is titled, U.S. Must Get Its Own House in Order, Quit Meddling in Other Nations' Affairs. Over the last few days, U.S. President Joe Biden and his administration have reiterated statements following purported protests in Cuba and the assassination of the former Haitian president, Jovenel Moïse. Joe Biden's administration has suggested they're ready to offer support and help Haiti, if necessary, in the form of U.S. troops. Meanwhile, the White House has also claimed, incredibly, that the U.S. government stands with the people of Cuba. For anyone with a remote understanding of history, these statements at best represent a government completely out of touch with reality, and at worst, betray a much more nefarious purpose behind the U.S. issuing words of support for both countries. Both Haiti and Cuba for decades have been subjected to actions and policies from the United States, both overt and covert, which have undermined self-determination and economic independence at every conceivable juncture. Outside of the United States, very few believe the notion that troops would be sent to other countries for any other reason than to promote American interests. The people of Cuba have been subjected to a blockade and sanctions by the United States for more than six decades, as well as dealing with multiple attempts over the years to undermine the country on a number of levels. Haiti, too, has continued to be punished and weakened by many nations, including the United States of America, ever since the nation produced perhaps the greatest victory against colonialism in recorded history, following the Slave Rebellion of 1804, which defeated the strongest forces of empire in the world. Neocolonialism has continued to be a tactic against the country ever since, as a price paid for freedom and in becoming the first nation to completely eradicate slavery. When comparing this record with the many examples of crisis and turmoil within the United States itself, the backward sense of priorities and hypocrisy becomes even clearer. And in an ever-evolving global landscape, the whole world sees it. Recently in New York, serious flooding revealed that the city, which is perhaps one of the richest in the world, has serious and long-standing issues with infrastructure. While the conversation is rightly centered around concerns over climate change, the impact of Storm Elsa revealed the neglect and vulnerability of services upon which millions of ordinary people depend. New York subways were flooded, resulting in perhaps some of the poorest sections of the working class being presented with a choice of either wading waist-deep into filthy, polluted, and dangerous water, or potentially compromising and jeopardizing their employment or family commitments. While many on the social media expressed sympathy for New Yorkers, others mocked the situation, suggesting that they themselves would never risk walking through littered subway water. But that's the point. Surely no one would take such a decision unless they had next to no choice. In a city which is home to some of the most affluent people and powerful institutions in the world, some of the most marginalized residents seem to have been abandoned to the mercy of extreme conditions that no one should be forced to navigate. Local emergency workers stepped in like heroes, but those too are ordinary people. The scene of the flooding, like everything, had been politicized by some seeking political power, and of course people would argue that the scenes in New York City are a localized issue. But while the floods and extreme weather have revealed quite literal cracks in America's infrastructure, a plethora of other problems reveal a country deep in crisis and on a number of levels. While, of course, Joe Biden won the presidential election last November, he won it by a narrow margin. The defeat of Donald Trump did not smash the forces that produced him on both the right and the left. His administration's subsequent pandering to unfounded fears about immigration, especially the visit by Vice President Kamala Harris to Guatemala, in which she told potential migrants don't come to the United States, reflects the fact that racism and nationalism is as present as ever in the country. The plague of anti-black racism and policing is arguably getting worse, also symptomatic of white supremacy and deep-seated racism, which will not simply be undone with a few political gestures here and there. And just like in the United Kingdom, the chasm between the richest in society and the poorest is as wide as ever, with some of the richest cities failing to house and safeguard the poorest people. The floods in New York City might be a result of hyper-capitalism and ultimately global capitalism with regards to the environmental crisis, but there are many more symptoms of the underlying cause of the latest catastrophe. So while the US government postures and issues statements about other countries, quite simply, there are a long list of problems at home to work through. rather than feigning support and so-called statements of solidarity for other countries, often in turmoil in part because of the military adventurism of the United States. The White House, with all of the power it possesses, needs to focus on fixing the never-ending list of problems within its own borders, not least for the sake of its own citizens and its global credibility. Weight of Chains. Part 2.
Yugoslav President Slobodan Milosevic. Milosevic reigned over what was left of Yugoslavia as it fell apart in the 1990s, surviving crippling UN sanctions, wars in Slovenia, Croatia, and Bosnia, violent Albanian separatism in Kosovo, NATO airstrikes against his country, an ICTY war crimes indictment, and 40 years of marriage with a control freak wife, Milosevic was definitely a force to be reckoned with. Naturally, such media were always described in NED literature as independent. The Democratic opposition refused to participate in the second round and called for a general strike.
Tens of thousands have answered the call of the Democratic opposition of Serbia for a five-day campaign of civil disobedience. The mass protests have already begun in Belgrade and other cities. Strikes and boycotts are also planned in a concerted effort to force Milosevic to accept the opposition's general election victory.
Sever had over 4,000 employees in the year 2000. After being sold to the Austrian company ATB in 2014, it had just 370 employees. However, in the next 3 months, by the end of 2000, Serbia had an average increase of prices by 52%. Thanks to stabilization, many domestic companies which could do good business had to close down. The West isolating and attacking Yugoslavia from 1992 to 2000 did great harm to the economy, but it seems that the West supposedly helping Yugoslavia as of 2000 made many things even worse. Why? From a historical standpoint, this made more sense.
Is it Greece? No. Is it the French Riviera? No. Is it Turkey? Austria? Switzerland? Rome? No. It's all Yugoslavia. A fascinating blend of all that attracts the traveler to Europe.
The country itself can best be described as the best of Europe.
Yugoslavia was an important player in the world, especially after World War II, when the United States took on the Soviet Union and made it its chief enemy. When Tito split from Stalin and formed a third way, not only Tito, this includes Nehru in India, it includes Tito, it includes Sukarno in Indonesia, and Gabdel Abdel Nasser in Egypt, and Nkrumah in Ghana. These are hugely rich countries with huge resources.
The socialist Yugoslavia was, in a way, a Casablanca of the Cold War. We were, neither in the West nor in the East, and we had relations with both. And Yugoslavia, as a leader of the non-aligned movement, had a role to play in this divided world.
There was a desire for neutrality, to avoid the arms buildup, to waste money, to use the resources of these countries to help people. in their countries.
However, shortly after the split with the Soviets in 1948, Yugoslavia, still shattered after World War II, needed to consolidate its economy and began to receive loans from the United States and the World Bank. The lives of those partisans were the price for the consolidation of Yugoslavia's economy. It didn't matter that Yugoslavia declared itself neutral.
John Foster Dulles, who was Eisenhower's Secretary of State, very clearly said that neutrality was immoral. This is a strange concept, but that was his attitude, that communism had to be rolled back. So the U.S. was taking a very aggressive position. Three of these five people that I mentioned were removed with the participation of the United States from power. Only two made it. Tito, who was a giant, because he fought as a partisan, he had a strong army and he had a strong base, and he was able to say no to Stalin. At the same time, the U.S. could not get in with him.
But the U.S. was able to slowly creep in with their loans.
The IMF was making loans into this region and, in a sense, not helping the situation financially. The U.S. had no interest in helping this situation heal itself.
But that, after all, is what neoliberalism was all about. The ideological foundation of what we call neoliberalism today was given by Ludwig von Mises and Friedrich von Hayek, two Austrian economists. Mises believed that egoism was the prime law of society, while Hayek claimed that a free market creates a spontaneous order that fixes the issues of economic calculation. In essence, neoliberals demand that you deregulate the market, privatize almost everything, cut government services, and by doing so, they believe the economy will pretty much fix itself. In 1947, an organization called the Mont Pelerin Society was formed to bring together neoliberal intellectuals around the world. The goal of the Mont Pelerin Society was not to convince the masses that neoliberalism was the way to go, as they considered the people to be mere followers of the elite. They shifted their attention to winning sympathies of intellectuals worldwide. A prominent member of the Mont Pelerin Society, called Milton Friedman, decided to get the ball rolling. As the leader of the Chicago School of Economics, Friedman started collaborating with the Catholic University of Chile, from which students were sent to the University of Chicago and were indoctrinated with neoliberalism. They returned to Chile and were ready to shape Chile's economy after the democratically elected government of President Salvador Allende was overthrown in a CIA-backed coup led by Augusto Pinochet on September 11, 1973.
Chile was a case in which a military regime headed by Pinochet was willing to switch the organization of the economy, and in that process, a group of people who had been trained at the University of Chicago in the Department of Economics, who came to be called the Chicago Boys, played a major role in designing and implementing the economic reforms.
Milton Friedman was also personally involved in the Chile experiment.
Well, I did make a trip to Chile, and I made talks in Chile. In fact, I did meet with Mr. Pinochet.
As they listened to Friedman's advice, the economy slowly started collapsing. Even though the elites, together with Friedman, were convincing the people that they were building a better society.
If you want to live in a society where your compatriots are poor and you are rich and you think that's better, a better society, then you would like it.
A Chilean family trying to live on the average wage had to spend 75% of its income on bread. Riding the bus or drinking milk became luxuries. Those who revolted were put in concentration camps. 100,000 people were jailed, thousands were killed.
I am more than willing to share in the credit for the extraordinary job that our students did down there.
In neighboring Argentina, President Isabel Perón was overthrown in a military coup. And as Friedman's disciples filled key economic positions in the country, within a year of the coup, wages dropped by 40%, factories closed, poverty spread, dissidents simply disappeared. The neoliberal coups didn't stop there. After Latin America, the economic policies of Milton Friedman spread to Western countries themselves. In Britain, Margaret Thatcher defeated the biggest union in the country, the mining union, and pushed through the neoliberal reforms, selling off the steel industry, water, electricity, gas, telephones, airlines, oil, and cutting many social programs. America, with President Ronald Reagan, did much of the same, widening the gap between the rich and the poor. The big prize, of course, was the Soviet Union.
Having won the Cold War,
And that led, of course, to the breakup of the Soviet Empire, both in the Warsaw Pact and Eastern European countries and within the Soviet Union itself. That has helped contribute to a movement toward democracy.
In fact, democracy was to be quickly trumped by Western financial interests, while Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev propagated a gradual transition to Scandinavian-style socialism with help from the West. He didn't understand what kind of help the West was ready to give.
The U.S. could have prevented the meltdown of the Soviet economy with an infusion of aid after Gorbachev withdrew the troops from Eastern Europe, but did not do so.
Few people knew what a radical transformation of the economy meant for the newly established Russian Federation. As a matter of fact, many Russian intellectuals were behind President Boris Yeltsin, whose advisors were also Friedman's disciples.
The Moscow intellectuals, you couldn't tell them what it was like. They were saying, oh, the poorest people in your country live better than I do. Here's a guy sitting there, he had a small apartment, okay, a wall of books, educated at Moscow University, speaks fluent English, never went hungry one day in his life. And we would say, well, we have people who live in doorways. They sleep in doorways. They eat out of garbage cans. I've seen them myself. And they say, oh, you don't have to lie to us. Oh, they don't. They would not believe it. America, America.
Yeah, you want America? You'll get America. A small number of businessmen in Russia became billionaires, better known as oligarchs, while a third of all Russians dropped below the poverty line. State industries were sold off at bargain prices. Boris Yeltsin, with full support of America, dissolved parliament as only a dictator could ensure the implementation of Friedman's economic policies. I think you get the picture here. Neoliberalism was imposed in dictatorships and in states of emergency, while the population was in shock. Something author Naomi Klein coined as the shock doctrine. The pioneer of shock therapy was an economist named Jeffrey Sachs, who traveled and administered his economic therapy to patient countries designated by the West. In 1991, Božidar Djelić, who would later become Serbia's Minister of Economy and Finances after Milosevic was deposed, met Jeffrey Sachs, who recruited him for 3 years of service in Poland and Russia as a top-level advisor to those countries' neoliberal reforms. In an interview for Harvard Business School, Djelić described the reforms as being honest with the patient and administering the dose of medicine required for recovery. Because when a patient needs to recover, shock is definitely the best medicine, eh? When I look at all the chaos that happened in all those countries, from the coups in Latin America, the Falklands War that allowed Thatcher to push through her policies, to the burning White House in Moscow after Yeltsin ordered its shelling, I can't help but wonder whether the burning Yugoslav Parliament building and TV station was meant to have the same effect. Maybe instead of looking at the smoke, we should have been looking what had already happened next door. This led to a hyperinflation in Croatia. This monetary policy, known as the quasi-fixed exchange rate, wasn't new. It was first adopted by Thailand in the 1980s. The way it works is you tie your country's official exchange rate to another country's currency. In this case, Croatia tied it to the euro. This creates the illusion of a fluctuating exchange rate, the illusion of a Croatian currency. Makes you wonder who runs the show when it comes to the Croatian economy. Was this the Croatia that its first president, Franjo Tuđman, had promised to the people when it declared independence from Yugoslavia in 1991, triggering a bloody war that lasted 4 years? A high-ranking official in Tuđman's party, the Croatian Democratic Union, or HDZ, in the 1990s, Domagoj Margetić, saw Tuđman's project in a different light from how the Croatian media presented him. This was the case in other countries as well during the Yugoslav wars, and money seemed to be a higher interest than winning territories through war, which even brought some leaders on opposite sides of the conflict together. Bora Milosevic was Slobodan Milosevic's brother. You can imagine how soldiers shooting at each other on the battlefield would feel if they knew their leaders and their families were working together on getting extremely rich. The project of dismantling a socialist country to create a rich minority and a poor majority is what neoliberalism was all about. This is why all of it was wholeheartedly supported by the West. Publicly, the West was condemning war profiteering and crimes against humanity. The International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, better known as the Hague Tribunal, was put in charge of punishing those who committed crimes. The chief prosecutor of the tribunal was Carlo Del Ponte.
I was all my life prosecutor in Switzerland, and Once Switzerland wanted to present me as candidate for the International Tribunal for Former Yugoslavia, I said yes because it was a new experience, a new challenge.
A challenge that proved to be quite difficult at times, especially when it came to investigating perhaps the most gruesome case of crimes against humanity and war profiteering there is, organ trafficking, which took place in Kosovo during the war.
In 1999, Kosovo Albanians put over 300 hostages in trucks and transported them across the border to northern Albania.
Before killing Serbs and members of other ethnic communities, Kosovo Albanians removed their vital organs and sold them for transplant.
The butchering reportedly took place in the Katuchi family house, which was dubbed the Yellow House, near the town of Burel in Albania.
I received a report about this issue, and I must say, at the very beginning, I did not believe it. I said, it's not possible. But the evidences we got confirms that it was reality, so it was my duty as prosecutor to continue this investigation. Unfortunately, it was not possible to continue.
Why not?
Because we have no cooperation. Albania was refusing us to investigate in the country because we have some indications that it was a mass grave there. UNMIC was not full cooperating with us, so we were obliged to suspend the investigation.
The head of UNMIC was Bernard Kouchner, and no one could explain why this investigation was being obstructed. When asked by a reporter if he himself was involved in the organ smuggling, Kouchner took it very seriously. One of those idiots and murderers, as Kouchner would describe them, would have to be, I guess, Swiss prosecutor to the Council of Europe, Dick Marty, as well, as he too talked about the Yellow House. In his 2010 report, Dick Marty uncovered that Hashim Thaçi, who was the prime minister of the self-proclaimed Republic of Kosovo at the time the report came out, was the head of a mafia-like group responsible for smuggling weapons, drugs, and human organs through Europe. As stated in the report, the so-called Kosovo Liberation Army, or KLA, held prisoners in a network of six facilities located in Albania, and Thaçi's Drenica group had the greatest responsibility for the prisons and the fate of those held there. The healthiest prisoners were transferred to a farmhouse near Fusha Kruja, where they were killed for their organs. Why didn't the West react?
Because Kylie was supporting NATO during the conflict. They have some difficulty to cooperate with us against the people who helped them. You know, it is politically, if you are my associate in a conflict, how can you act against, against my associate?
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
In the limelight.
The raging wildfires are stoked by a wave of exceptional temperatures across the United States western region, combined with a prolonged drought that has desiccated vegetation. Western United States has grown warmer and drier in recent decades as a result of the climate crisis, accelerating the wildfires and making the job of controlling them more difficult. We're prepared for you an article written jointly by Ed Pilkington and Gabrielle Cannon. The piece is titled Western U.S. and Canada Brace for Another Heat Wave as Wildfires Spread. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. Fourth searing heat wave in 5 weeks is set to strike western United States and Canada in the coming days, aggravating wildfires that are already ravaging an area larger than Rhode Island, as drought and record-breaking temperatures tied to the climate crisis pummel the region. According to the National Interagency Fire Center, the impending heat wave comes as 12 states are already battling 71 active wildfires. The combined area of the blazes is about 1,553 square miles, that is 4,021 square kilometers. The largest blaze by far continues to be the Bootleg Fire in south-central Oregon, which has been burning for 9 days now and has devastated an area larger than New York City, with no sign of letting up. As of Thursday morning, 15th of July, the fire was at only 7% containment, and the cause remained unknown. Almost 2,000 houses are currently threatened by the Bootleg wildfire. Tim McCarley described to the Associated Press having to flee his home in a rural area north of Bly. He said, "The sheriff's department had been there, and they said, if you don't get out of here right now, then you're going to die." He added, "We were running around like a chicken with a head cut off, throwing stuff into the car. Then we say, okay, that's it, we've got to go." They evacuated from the flames, which came within just 5 feet or 1.5 meters of their house. Several large wildfires are also burning across Northern California, including the Dixie Fire, which erupted on Wednesday, 14th of July, and has grown to more than 2,250 acres, close to where the deadly 2018 campfire tore through the town of Paradise, remains at 0% containment. Lynette Round, an information officer with California Fire, said, "It's a lot of steep and inaccessible terrain, and that's making it really difficult to get containment." She added, "Ground crews have to hike in, so it is a lot of work for the firefighters." the early hours of Wednesday, 14th of July, the fire raced along the steep terrain about 10 miles or 16 kilometers from the town of Paradise in Northern California. The current fire, which erupted in the rugged Feather River Valley, northeast of the town of Paradise, has not advanced towards it, and residents have not been ordered to evacuate their homes. Larry Peterson, whose home in neighboring Magalia survived the previous blaze, said some of his neighbors were getting their belongings together in case they had to flee the region. He told KHSL-TV, "Anytime you've got a fire after what we went through and another one is coming up, you've got to be concerned." Other local residents stocked up on water and other items. Jennifer Uni of the town of Paradise said, "We pretty much left with our clothes on our backs during the previous wildfire," she added, "so this time we're looking to be more prepared and more vigilant." Joyce McLean's home burnt last time, but she rebuilt it and would again rebuild if necessary. McLean said, "We just take each day as it comes and if it happens," she added, "there's not much that we can do about it." Bill Connolly told the Sacramento Bee Daily, "Because little of the foliage has grown back in the area since the 2018 Paradise blaze, there is nothing there now for the current wildfire to burn," the Butte County supervisor. While in Mariposa County in California, the river fire was brought to 36% containment after destroying five structures and burning through 9,500 acres of land. Evacuation orders were lifted as crews worked to mop up hotspots, but officials warned that years of drought and disease have weakened many trees, and those dead and down trees and logs continue to pose problems. The number of acres burnt in California this year is already eclipsing the number by this time last year, which also set a state record. By the end of 2020, roughly 4.1 million acres of land had been scorched in California. Lynette Round, an information officer with California Fire, said, "Last year was quite an anomaly in August, when we had over 14,000 lightning strikes that caused multiple wildfires at one time. Hopefully that does not happen again this year," she added, "but what we are seeing this year is we didn't have as much rainfall, and that makes the fuels more susceptible to burning." The raging wildfires are stoked by a wave of exceptional temperatures across western United States region, combined with a prolonged drought that has desiccated vegetation. Western United States has grown warmer and drier in recent decades as a result of the climate crisis, accelerating the wildfires and making the job of controlling them even more difficult. More than 60% of the Western United States is suffering exceptional or extreme drought right now, the highest rating since the authorities began monitoring the phenomena 20 years ago. Temperatures have also reached historic levels, with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, the NOAA, marking 585 all-time records in the past 30 days. Emphasizing that residents in the area must remain vigilant, Rand said, "When we have heat waves like this, we're always concerned." Writing in the Washington Post, meteorologist Matthew Cappucci said the next punishing heat wave is expected to start in the coming days and reach a critical peak by the next 10 days. It will be centered on a swath of the Rocky Mountains in the United States and